I'm John Fletcher with KVMR FM, and I am at Ananda Village, and I'm going to be interviewing Swami Kriyananda. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank both Joytesh and Davey for arranging this, and thank you for agreeing to an interview, Swami.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You are embarked upon a rather ambitious project regarding YouTube and Indian television.
Well, I've already done the YouTube, and I've almost finished the Indian television. The YouTube is 108 programs on the Bhagavad Gita, 10 minutes each or near that. And the one for India is to replace a program I had before, which was every day in the year, and it went to about 20 million homes in India. But we had to stop it because we're building a community and needing the money to build that community. Now, this will be for one day a week for 52 weeks all the year around. And I've done all but the last six, which I'll do tomorrow. So I'm nearly finished. I've been involved, but the involvement is coming to an end.
For listeners who might not be familiar with the Bhagavad Gita, that is a sacred Hindu text.
It is. It's really, in a way, just about the greatest scripture in the world. Not that the other scriptures don't tell the truth, but usually they tell them in connection with he went here and he did that and stories and so on. This is just one after another, deep truths. And they're the highest kind of truth. The goal of life, it says, is to unite our souls with God. There's really only one religion in the world. It's not Hinduism, it's not Christianity. It's the eternal religion, which would have to be the same religion on the most distant planet in the most distant galaxy in the universe, which is that everything has come from God, everything is his dream, everything must go back to God. And the duty of all creatures is to wake up to their association with him and to reclaim their oneness with him.
The work that you are taking this from, that's commentaries?
The Bhagavad Gita, actually, it's a small part of a very long epic. What happens is that Arjuna, the hero, you might say, of the epic, and Krishna, who is a representative of God and also acts as his teacher, he drives him between the forces of two armies. These armies represent the inner citizens of our own nature, which each quality we have, greed, anger, kindness, compassion, all the qualities, good, bad, and indifferent, that a human being has, really are in a sense like citizens of a country. And we are the country, and those qualities are our citizens. And these are in all people pitted against each other. We have those things within us which lead us toward virtue. We have those things which try to pull us away from virtue. And this war is really an inner war between the soul and matter and material desire. And this scripture is the dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna on the battlefield. But it's all symbolic.
You came to the Bhagavad Gita through Paramahansa Yogananda as a disciple.
Actually, I found it first. I was studying playwriting in South Carolina in Charleston, and I was becoming very hungry to know God. I thought maybe I was losing my mind. I didn't know that anybody had ever sought God before. I'd never read about these things. And I remember talking with somebody in a restaurant, and he told me the book you should read is the Bhagavad Gita. And I didn't know anything about it, but the name rung a deep bell inside me, and I made it a point to read that. And then the next two or three days later, I read Autobiography of a Yogi and took the next bus from New York to Los Angeles, where Yogananda was living. The first words I said to him were words I never had imagined myself saying to anybody, I said, I want to be your disciple. And that was 61 years ago, and I'm still his disciple.
There, you have an anniversary coming up.
Yes, the 12th of September will be the 61st anniversary of my meeting with him.
That must be a very exciting thing for you.
Well, the excitement has gone on for 61 years.
Yes, I can see that in your face.
Yeah.
You're also working on, or you finished, updating your book, The Path, I understand.
Yes. You know, after 30 years, I figured, well, I've grown a little bit, and I hope in wisdom, and I wanted to add to it. I've added many stories, deleted a few stories, and expanded on things. So it's really a much better book now. And it's just coming out. We're going to have our formal launch of it at the Ford Amphitheater in Los Angeles on the 25th.
Now, I read The Path, and I'm seeing your copy there. That's considerably thicker than the one that I read. So
it is, yeah, it's longer now.
Looks like it is somewhat expanded.
Well, I have to say, I don't know if an author should say this, but I'm saying it. I'm excited about it.
Well, I think that it's good to be excited about
it. Yeah.
It's your child, in a way. The... You are going to, I understand, be... You're sought after by Italian television and a movie maker.
Well, this is happening. A director in Italy wants to do a movie about my life and about the new path. And I hope they get a handsome enough young man to represent me. And so that will be one thing. I'm going to Italy on the 14th of October. And the other thing will be that a television station called Anima wants to do a two-hour documentary on me. So there'll be that. Then, of course, there are other things because we have a set ashram there, a community there.
So how are the communities going? I mean, you have...
About eight communities.
Eight?
In America, in California, we have three. In Washington, we have one. In Oregon, we have one. So that's five. Italy is six. And India, we have two. One just coming up, making eight in all.
Now, this is... Ananda Village is the hub community.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And as a little reminder to our listeners, how did Ananda get started?
How did
Ananda get started?
Well, I didn't have any wealthy donors. I had to do it myself. So I was giving classes on yoga, meditation, asanas, postures, and so on. I didn't charge much. I wanted the people to have it for as little as possible. So I charged $15 for 6 weeks on either Hatha Yoga or Raja Yoga meditation, or 25 if they took both courses. And fortunately, I was a popular teacher. I had about 300 students at a time. And with that, I built the money. I gained the money to buy the land here and build the first buildings. Since then, other people have come, and now we're all doing it together.
The one thing that impresses me so much about Ananda is that so many spiritual communities are rather insular and are distrustful of outsiders. What I've seen of Ananda and what I've known of their members is that they are very active members in the community at large.
Well, we feel we should be. We owe it to our fellow men. We don't live in a vacuum. Nobody lives in a vacuum. We should show gratitude to the neighborhood, to the place where we live, to the country we live in, to the world. And I think this attitude of gratitude, poor poetry, is a very important thing for everybody. People who rape the world, getting what they want and showing no appreciation for what they receive, I think they're bringing this world into a bad position right now. And I think that whatever depression we're falling into, which I think will be much worse, is due to the avarice in people. I don't think we should think that way. We should think that we're a part of a world family And it's our duty to help other people.
Ananda seems to be growing, both here and abroad. How many members are...
I don't know. We've never actually counted, but I would estimate probably about 1,000 throughout the world. Plus, we have many thousands who are closely associated with us, but don't live here because they have family and responsibilities and so on. Family members who wouldn't come here and that sort of thing.
Now, Ananda has many, it's in a lot of ways it's self-contained. Has many services for its people and the people here. And I understand you're building a new art center.
Yes, and we try to be self-supporting. Of course, we rely on donations too to grow more quickly. But we have several businesses, I think it's in the 30s, that are self-supporting and that bring money to the people and to the community. And so all of that.
So this would be sort of an extension of Yogananda's
He had the idea that what would really change the world would be groups of people living according to the teachings. If we had every member of Ananda go to a different city and practice meditation, get a job in a business or something, live in a suburb, his influence would be minimal. People would see his peace in the office and they'd say, well, how come you're so peaceful? And he'd say, well, I meditate. And they'd say, oh, it's probably because you take bran for breakfast or something. Yeah. But in fact, when you get a whole group of people together, somebody said to me a few years ago, you have some wonderful people here. I said, if you met one or two, you could say they're wonderful people, but when you see a whole community dedicated to kindness and service, and we don't find harmful emotions here. We find people that are at peace and trying to help each other. When you see a group of people like that, it makes an impression. And we have people coming from all over the world to visit us just to find out how this works. I seriously think that this will be a new pattern of living for the future.
Plans to create other communities around the world?
I think that this idea, Yogananda said this idea would spread like wildfire. But how much can we do it? The more big we come, the more organizational we are. I don't like that. I like little autonomous communities. And we have found that it's not so easy to find that leadership is a talent. Leadership has to be somebody who's there to serve people, not to rule over them. It's easy to drive people. It's more difficult to lead them. And we're trying to lead people. To get people with those talents is not so easy. I don't know that we have enough people here to be able to start such communities, maybe a few. But I think that what I hope to do, I do hope to do, is to inspire people everywhere. They don't have to follow this teaching. But to inspire them, and I think that in this time of serious depression which is coming up, it's very important for people to get land in the country with a few friends and grow their own food, not to have mortgages. And, recently, just the other day, a nephew of mine told me that in Detroit, and I haven't been watching the news, so maybe our listeners know this, but I heard it from him, that in Detroit, to bring food into the inner city, they had to have people riding gun on the truck to protect it from marauders. That's going to become a common thing in this country. If you have land where you can grow your own food, that is the much, much the greatest security you can have.
I interviewed a man named Andrew McLeod, who is very active in both studying and helping to create both co-ops and collectives. And he uses, his spiritual basis is the second book of Acts in the Bible.
Jesus reminds the same need.
Right. But he was telling me that in places, and there are areas of, particularly in northern Italy, where 80% of the businesses are either worker-owned or cooperatives and collectives.
Well, as you know, we have a community in Italy, and we have formed sort of a partnership with a lot of those communities, Damanur up in the north near Turin is a very big one, and they've printed their own currency. And I've talked there, and they've come and talked to us, and we have a good connection, but this is important. We can't all do it ourselves. We're not sectarian. We need to inspire people, whatever their belief system, whatever their interests are, work together with others and get land where you can grow your own food. This is a message I want to carry to the whole country.
I noticed on the drive up here that you have, Ananda has a very impressive garden.
Yes. We also have a, well, ecologically friendly, we have a permaculture system, which is a means of helping several plants to help each other in the products of food. We're very conscious of not only the need for it, but how to do it best.
So besides the path and the movie projects and the YouTube and television, what else are you doing?
Well, I've written over 100 books.
That I know.
All of them to try to get people to understand that if they include spiritual principles in whatever they're doing, be it school, be it marriage, be it business, be it anything, that everything will go better for them than if they try to do it only with their own egotistical intelligence. So what I'm now doing, what I hope to get back to doing, is to write a book on a new style of monasticism, where people, whether they're married or single, can be renunciates at heart. And this will be a whole order which I hope to found.
That that is one of those projects that seems like it would be a lifetime project to start.
Well, I agree with you. And here I am, 83. I have fortunately younger people who can help to take over. In one of the, I know somebody said to me that of all the ashrams and communities in America, the only one I see surviving the death of its founder is Ananda. And the reason is that they've tried to do it all themselves. I've always delegated authority. I know that one person can't do it all. So I have encouraged and nourished leadership in others. And I don't do it. I'm pretty well retired. But still, I'm an important voice in the community. But others do it. And I have, in this room, we have the leaders of this community, Palo Alto community, and so on. But, that, the, yeah, go ahead.
What I've seen of this, the leadership in this community is it's really, it stands out above, you know, most leaderships in certainly the secular world.
I mean, well, the reason I feel that it's true is that our leaders, I select people for leaders who want to serve, who don't want to be served. This is very important. And yes, it's true. The secular world, I've written a book. I was in Australia some 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and they're very sort of conceited people as a nation. They're individuals always everywhere who shine, but that's a common consciousness there. And they were very opposed to the idea of communities led by anybody. And on the other hand, they were all for the government taking care of them. And I gave several talks on leadership and how to be a good leader. Well, this book I wrote in the art of supportive leadership, and it's been taken on by quite a few big business like Mitsubishi and Kellogg and so on. And they've taught this to their executives. And I've also written a course. It was interesting because I was in the hospital in India with double pneumonia. And a doctor came into my room. He said, "Sir, can you help me?" Well, I was practically unconscious. And he said, "I have a son in college in Canada, and I have many responsibilities. How can I make ends meet and be completely honest and righteous?" And I said, but I was not an example for success in my unconscious state. I said, "I have learned from experience that by rigid adherence to Dharmic law, I have been more successful than I could have been otherwise." I couldn't impress him with that statement. And the next day, my cook, Leela, came in to cook for me, bring me food rather from home, because I didn't like the hospital food. And I said, Leela, I should write a course on this. Well, anyway, I spent the next year and a half writing this course. And Success and Happiness Through Ryokai and Spiritual Living. And it's a very good course, but it makes its point. And I would love for people to really read this.
I understand that in May you had a health
issue. I think I was ready to check out at that time. I'm 83, and that's not an age when you worry when people die. It's not as if they were dying young. And I left India. Just before I left India, I felt something. Everything went black for me, just for a few moments. And the next day, I was to leave India, and I couldn't remember things. And it surprised me. My mind, I think I had a mini stroke. And I got to Italy, where I was to land. I went up to Switzerland. I had to go in a wheelchair. People had to carry me up the stairs in a wheelchair. I was hardly able to do anything. And my nurse told me I could easily have died from any one of three basic reasons. And then I was feeling a lot of bliss. I've never been afraid of death. And I felt bliss, and I said, God, you can take me any time. I'm happy to go. But I'm equally happy to stay if you want me to serve you. And all of a sudden, I became well. And I can stride around without any problem, and I have all the energy I could imagine. And I suppose I'm good for, or bad for, whatever word you want to use, for another 10 years or so at the moment.
Well, when I saw you at the bookstore, because the last year when we did our interview, you were having a few, not major health issues, but you were recovering from. And both my wife and I were just surprised at how radiant and how strong you looked. And
it's not my doing. He has something to say in it.
You have led a rather, well, by anyone's standards, a remarkable life. Are there, and I know that Yogananda was the central figure in your life. Are there any other highlights that come to mind?
I have met other saints, and especially in India, but not only there, and they have been a great inspiration to me. I would say that anything I would call a highlight would have to be on that level. I'm not too interested in fulfilling personal desires. I don't have them. But I do love the company of saints. Anandamoyi Maha in India was a great inspiration to me. In a way, she was more so even than my guru, because when I knew my guru, I was very young and sort of in awe of his greatness. Whereas with her, it was like having my own mother. It was very dear to me. I met other saints there who were also very dear. So I would say on that level, that would be the highlights of my life. On another level, I would say that everything that I have done, I've written lots of music and lots of books and so on, started communities. Everything I've done, I have tried to find what would help other people. And I've seen that by not doing it myself, by asking him to inspire me, I've been able to do 100 times more than I would have been able to do if I thought I'm doing it.
So your recommendation to people would be service.
Service to people, and feel that God is inspiring you. I know that I've had the dual thought in my life. I personally can't do anything. In fact, when I wanted to be a playwright, I gave up writing because I realized I didn't know truth, and what was the point in writing for people if I couldn't help them to know truth? So I gave up writing. But when I met my guru, he gave me the truths and the insights that would make it possible. And I have seen, for example, in writing music, I don't say, well, what direction do I want the notes to go? I ask God and Guru and my higher self, whatever, to tell me what to do. And I find that instantly, without even thinking, I have the inspiration. And so I've written whole suites in an hour, or a string quartet in a day. These things would be impossible if I was thinking just with my mind. But I don't think with my mind. I listen. I offer the question up, help me to get say this. And suddenly it's all there. And in the books, too, I don't spend hours worrying how to do this, how to say that. It just comes to me by holding my mind up in a listening attitude.
Do you attribute that to years of yogic practice?
I attribute it above all to attitude, to realize that I can't do anything, but he can do everything.
And do you believe that, or have you met what you would believe living saints today?
Saints who are now at this time alive, because I've met saints, but all of them that I have met are not alive any longer. There must be, but I am sad to say I do not know them.
Do you think that we're going through sort of a spiritual drought, for want of a better word?
You know, I think we're going through a period of great change in the planet. There were centuries where people were thinking only that matter is real, that fixed things are the reality. They had to confine their thoughts in dogmas and formulae and so on. I think we've come into an age of energy. And in this age of energy, there's much more fluid thinking. But we see a tension growing on this planet between people who want things the old way and people who are able to understand and accept the new way of flowing with truth. And I think this is leading to a massive depression worldwide. I think it'll lead to world war. I think it'll lead to great suffering on this planet. But I do think that when we come out at the other end of the tunnel, we'll be in a much better world.
So you believe that the depression is not simply economic, but it's a depression of sort of the global soul?
I would say that everything that happens is an expression of the global soul, or I would say the global ego, because the global soul can't be affected. It's a part of God. But people's egos, that's why you find so much terrorism. And, you know, I was just looking at some pictures somebody sent me of declassified photos of the World Trade thing on 9/11. You know, at that same time, there were people in Palestine dancing with joy in the streets. Hard to believe. But this planet has a lot of evil in it. And I think that coming into a new age, there's going to have to be an eruption of some kind. I sort of think of our planet as being almost like a living creature that needs to shake off a few fleas.
I've heard that analogy before, that, you know, the earth is scratching itself and the fleas are...
Yes.
How do we change that, the patterns in our own lives? I know it all has to start with individuals and work its way out.
We have to understand that the more we emphasize our own needs, the less we have those needs fulfilled. People who think in terms of taking and getting rather than of giving are never really happy people. They get everything they want and they're still unhappy. I've known a number of rich people in my life. I can't remember seeing almost any of them being happy. Those that were happy were rich and used their riches for the benefit of other people. But again and again, it comes down to if you can expand your sense of ego to include the welfare of others, to have a sense of kindness and sense of giving to others, this will ensure your own happiness. And I think the greatest thing people need to learn is if there's anything that goes wrong in their lives, don't blame other people. Blame your own karma. You're the one who attracted it.
Yeah, there's with a lot of books and programs that I've seen, there is this discussion of the law of attraction. And you're seeing that it's some of its proponents are people like Jerry Zhukov. And then there are some scientists. And Zhukov is saying it's the law of attraction is not meant you get all the women, and no. You know, it's meant to attract. You attract like energy attracts like energy, and if you wish to attract positive change, then you have to be positive.
And if you want to be loved, you have to give love. And if you want riches, give people. The more you give, the more you get. And I know this is true. There was somebody whom I picked up as a hitchhiker back in the days when I was not very rich. I had $50 to my name, and that's all. And this man seemed a needy man, and I gave him $25, which was half of my worldly goods. And he said, I will be sure you get this back. I don't want to lose your faith in human nature. I said, listen, if I'd had faith in human nature, I'd have lost it years ago. It isn't your human nature. I'm not giving this to you with the thought of your repaying me. I'm giving it to God through you. He never did repay me, but I never lost my peace of mind because I'd given it to him in the first place. And I found that money came back to me a thousandfold.
In my experience, when I've given something freely and without expectation of it returning, just the feeling alone.
Yes.
Adequate.
I will never lend money to anybody. If I'm in a position to give it, I'll give it. But I won't lend it. Because I know that, as Shakespeare said, loan oft loseth both its friend, itself and friend. And so I'd rather keep those friends.
And Franklin paraphrased it being a borrower or
neither a borrower nor a lender be. Yeah. For loan oft loseth both itself and friend.
Yes. You are surrounded here by great beauty and obvious great love. What does that feel like to you?
I give it to God. There was somebody once who praised a lecture I had given, and I said, well, God is the doer. She said, oh, really? As if I knew it was good. I didn't know it was that good. That's not what I mean. But he's done everything, and I've just been perhaps a very poor channel, but I've tried to be a good channel. And that's all it means to me. I don't take it as my glory or even my satisfaction. I've done it for him, and it's his.
Do you have a very active schedule?
Yes.
do you still enjoy the presentations, the lectures, the teaching?
You know, one thing that keeps me enjoying it, and I do, is that every time I've given a lecture, and I've given lectures on the same subject many, many times, I don't have my lecture written out. After I've given a lecture, I wipe the slate clean, so that when I speak on the same subject, I speak completely spontaneously and without any reference to what I've done before. I'm very much not like those people who say, and as I always say, I never always say. I speak just from the inspiration of the moment. So it keeps it fresh. And I can enjoy it that way. And sometimes I sit back and I think, gee, I wish I'd thought of that one.
You are, well, at 83, obviously you're past the midpoint of your life.
I certainly hope so.
What kind of advice do you give people for living their life? Or do you give advice for living?
I give it constantly. But it's always my talks are never teaching. I never feel that I teach anybody. I share with people what I have learned. And that's the limit of it. I never have felt that I was a teacher. And in counseling people, it's the same thing. But I share my experience of life. And I have found that I am much more peaceful if I don't think what I'm getting, but what I can give. If I'm always even-minded so that if things go badly, it doesn't bother me. When things go well, I don't go jumping up and down. I find that that attitude doesn't make me apathetic. It makes me feel joy all the time.
Well, there is a real difference between apathetic and being centered. And I think that
being a what?
Centered.
Yes, exactly. And many people don't see it. You do.
Yeah.
But it's very important.
And do you think that in this country, do you think we've lost our moral compass? Or?
No, I don't. But I think we've gotten away from it. You know, one of the troubles is with science. They tell us that there are no values, everything is relative. I've written books to help to show that everything is relative to, just as Einstein's relativity was relative to the speed of light, and it was relative of motion, not of other things. So philosophers and ethical teachers who say everything's relative, therefore it doesn't matter what you do, that's a misunderstanding. Everything must be understood to be relative to one absolute, and that is Satchitananda, ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss, which is the classic definition of the divine consciousness.
I just this morning saw some pictures that were taken from the revised or repaired Hubble.
Oh, they're wonderful. I have a book of it here. They're just absolutely...
And it's amazing because what we're seeing is a universe that we never expected.
I know. And how could God not have joy in that creation?
Well, there's, even in the hardened sciences, you're hearing people, particularly in the realm of biology, talking about the intelligence of life, the matrix of intelligence behind everything.
God,
that's basically couched in scientific.
How did the universe come into existence? It's a dream in the mind of the Creator. Nothing substantial. The things that seem solid are really energy. And energy is only a vibration of thoughts. And those thoughts are vibrations in the consciousness of the infinite. And so everything has consciousness. It's not self-conscious, but there's consciousness even in the rocks. And they have found with plants, for example, if you give love to one plant, it will flourish. If you give hatred and disgust and disdain to another, it will die. And so we are little points. God is center everywhere, circumference nowhere. And each soul is a little point trying to increase its consciousness. And that increasing awareness is the subtle explanation for evolution. Darwinian evolution gives us mechanics. This gives us the how to and the why, really.
Yeah, I read the anarchist naturalist Peter Kropotkin.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote Charles Darwin's bulldog, Thomas Huxley, wrote a book called On the Struggle for Survival. And Kropotkin could not let it stand.
I can't let that stand either.
That communities of living beings that come together in community thrive much better than individuals on their own.
And we've seen this evil in the communists, in the Nazis, and in our times we've seen these things. No, it's by working together and by love above all. And love is a manifestation of joy. So underneath everything, joy. When we work with that kind of spreading, expansive joy, we can bring harmony to this planet.
Do you think that, there's been some heinous crimes, certainly throughout history, but we're seeing it in our own time with torture and unjust wars. Do you think that these individuals involved, is there any redemption for them?
There has to be, because everything is an expression of God. There's no such thing as sin unless you understand sin to mean ignorance. People don't make God angry by the way they behave, but they suffer themselves because they go against the law of their own nature. And people who think that they can get what they want by power over people, brutalizing other people, and so on. They suffer, they have to. The karmic law is supreme. But over many, many, many lifetimes, they learn this lesson of what works and what doesn't work. And so gradually they come out of those evils. And I'm sure I've been just as bad as the worst person in the world. Because we have to go through everything to reach that point where we understand that that's not going to give us what we want. If we want what we want, we have to learn to be humble. We have to learn to be self-giving. We learn to have to learn to love.
Can we redeem ourselves in one lifetime?
That is possible but difficult. It says in the Bhagavad Gita that even the worst of the sinners can come to God, but if he meditates and seeks God. There have been examples. For one, a good example, and I'm not sure that it is a really valid one, because although the story is beautiful, I can't help thinking that having been told by the person himself, he was coloring things a bit. But Valmiki wrote the Ramayana. Valmiki was a highway robber, and he would support his family by robbing people. And one time he met a group of sannyasis walking, and he demanded either their money or their lives. They said, "Well, I'm sorry, we don't have any money." So he said, "Well, it's my principle. If you don't have money to give me, I have to kill you." And they said, "Well, do you think that your parents, your wife, your children, would they be willing to share the bad karma you get from killing us?" He said, "Well, of course, I'm doing this for them. Of course they would." They said, "Go home. Ask them. We'll wait here for you. You can come back and kill us if you like. But go to your wife and go to your children first." And he went home and he said, "Well, do you accept the bad karma I'm getting for supporting you in this way?" They said, "Oh, no, never. Why would we take your bad karma? How you support us is your business, but we're certainly not going to take your bad karma from you." And he realized that that was no true love. He was doing it out of a false sense of attachment. And he came back to the saints and he said, "I will follow you. I will be your disciple." So they tried to teach him meditation, and they said, "Take the name of Rama," which is the name of God. And he was so evil, he couldn't say Rama, but he could say Mara, which means death, and Satan. So they said, "Well, say that." So he kept saying Mara, Mara, Mara. It became Rama, Rama, Rama. So in this way, Valmiki, who was a highway robber, and he says he was the worst sinner in the world, and that's what you have to take with a grain of salt, he became a great saint, and he wrote the Ramayana, or the story of the life of Rama.
I think that there's also a Tibetan? Milarepa.
Milarepa is a very good example.
Yeah,
Milarepa, they pronounce it. Yeah. Yes, he to obey his mother, used black magic to destroy all these relatives who had tried to destroy her. And he realized he had very bad karma, and he had to pay it off in some way. And he took yoga and learned, and he became liberated in that life. So that's a very good example, better than the one I gave you.
Yes, it's so it is possible.
Yes, it's possible.
Since that is probably not what we can all expect, we certainly... what would you suggest in a way of just living a better life or trying to cleanse?
Any step you make toward heart purity, purifying your heart of egotism and selfishness and anger and jealousy and all the qualities that pull us down, every step you take in that direction will be a step upward, and your life will become more and more shining. It may take lifetimes, but why not start now?
It's like what the Buddhist saying, start where you are.
Yes.
Or begin where you are.
Yes.
So you divide yourself, your time between...
Italy, America, and India.
India.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that all of them have both aesthetic and spiritual pulls on your heart.
In a sense, but nothing has a pull in another sense. So I could never see it again and be perfectly happy.
Well, this area, for all its beauty, it has some rather heavy karma with the gold rush and the massacre of Indians.
You know, America, basically, my guru said, has basically very good karma. And yes, it has a little bad karma from the way it treated Indians. Yes, it, of course, every country has bad karma, but look at the other way. What country in history has been attacked by other countries, like Japan and Pearl Harbor, has fought that war, has beaten the enemy down, and then has stooped to help them? This generosity of the American nature is very good karma, and America, my guru said, will end up, it'll win out against all obstacles.
Bismarck said, when he said America is great because America is good,
yes,
she will cease being great when she ceases being
good. That's exactly right.
So, well, I think that the other place that you have sort of hung your hat is near Assisi.
Yes.
Which is a great, well, certainly one of my favorite saints is Francis.
Well, that's why I settled there.
Do you find it, is there sort of a radiant spirit?
There is.
A place?
There is. You know, when I first went to the Portiuncolo in Assisi, this is many years ago, I felt the presence and blessings of St. Francis. And it was so childlike and sweet and humble, and just all-embracing in its love. And I asked him, how is it possible for a human being to be so childlike and so sweet? And he answered me, by never judging, by accepting all men as your brothers and sisters, and by loving God, but above all, by judging no one.
A very remarkable man. Well, saint. What... Now, where is your...
it's between Assisi and the town of Gualdo-Tadino. It's about 18 miles, I guess, north of Assisi toward Gualdo.
And you have a community in India.
We have community, yes, in Assisi. We have several hundred acres there. Then we have a community in Gurgaon, which is outside Delhi. And now we're starting one near Pune, and we have 30 acres of land, 25 or 30... not quite sure, 30, I think. And they're building me a house there. And at the end of the year, I'll go back there.
How big is Ananda Village?
We have close to 1,000 acres.
1,000 acres. It certainly is a serene and beautiful place.
Yeah.
And
well, across the river here, this is all national forest.
Okay.
So it'll never be built on.
So Ananda is expanding here. I mean, there's
yes.
new building projects.
It's expanding everywhere. You know, when people suffer economically, that's when they start thinking more seriously. Many more people are coming to us now because of their financial difficulties. They begin to see that human security, material security, is not security. So, but we are also, the message that we're teaching is a message specifically directed to our times. We're not trying to take people out into some other age. As you said, we try to relate to people in our times, and we're not trying to separate ourselves from society. And so everything we do is actually, it's the spiritual dimension, you might say, or octave of everyday life.
Do you find that also in Italy? And in
everywhere. Everywhere. I have to say that in Italy, I and Ananda are better known than here, because America is such a huge country, and India is more focused. So this is why a movie director there is offering to do my life. There's no one in Hollywood offering. And that goes across the board. My book, The Revelations of Christ, is selling very well there. Not selling so well here. There's just such a huge country. Anything you do, a week later, it sort of vanished into the waves.
Yeah, I think Americans go from tragic incident to tragic incident, and the same with the reading and with our TV shows and all that. We're bombarded by images, and my feeling is that the average American has a a very, very short attention span.
Well, I'm afraid this is true everywhere where there's television. I remember, I don't watch it myself, but I went to a barbershop in Rome a few years ago, and he had a television in his shop there. And I noticed that every 2 seconds this image changed. Well, what does that say for the minds of the people watching it? They must be terribly restless.
I heard an interview the other night with an old friend who's gone now, Utah Phillips. And he refused to own a television set for 40-some years. And Amy Goodman, who was interviewing him, asking about television, and he said exactly the same thing, this bombardment of images. You can't fix on anything because it keeps changing.
I have a TV screen, but I don't use it to watch TV. I like a few old movies. I don't like new movies. I remember there was a review of a movie in India which said, if that movie wasn't violent enough for you, this one will do it. That's terrible. So no, I don't watch that kind of thing. And the movies I watch are mostly in the 30s and 40s, when there was a nicer element then.
Plot-driven.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a very, for me, both enlightening and wonderful experience.
Well, I'm very happy to be here and with you.
Yes, and I wanted to thank you. And again, thank Devi and Joytesh for putting this together. And hopefully next year we can do this again.
I would like to think so. I do think so. And I hope so. And I would like to tell all our listeners that even though I don't know you face to face, you have my love because you're a brother or a sister in God.
Thank you. I think that's important for people to hear.
It's always good at the end to remind people.
Just as an addendum, I'd like to remind people that you can find your talks on the Bhagavad Gita on YouTube.
Yes.
Correct? And how do you look that up?
Well, you look up under YouTube, you look up the Bhagavad Gita, and my name is Swami Kriyananda. We've only been doing this for a few weeks. We have over 9,000 viewers, so it seems to be doing well. Personally, I never watch it, so I don't know. And then the programs I'm doing for TV in India, they will be available on our internet for Mananda, so they can be seen anywhere else too.
Do you think there's any chance of those being shown, say, on public television in this country?
If I don't have to pay for it, I'd love it. But if it's paying for, what you have to pay in this country to be heard in one city, I can pay in India and be heard by the whole country of over a billion people.
A few rupees.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again.
Okay. Yours to you.